Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. On our show, we get a previous guest to ask a question of our current guest. So take a listen.
The thing that at the moment that is crowding almost all other concerns out is my concern for climate change and rising sea levels. And I'm wanting to know if it's true for others.
And here's what our upcoming guest had to say.
As a board member of the MacArthur Foundation, one of the things we think a lot about is how we impact climate change. And I think that's, to me, the really interesting and difficult question is it important to get people to understand and believe the science and for us to win the argument about climate change? Or is it important to focus singularly on trying to figure out ways to mitigate and to recover from and deal with the impacts of climate change? And so the theory of change around climate change is actually quite complicated and something that all of us don't have a consensus around.
That's Joy Ito, the director of MIT's Media Lab. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what is this thing that you run? I've been there and I've seen like weird musical instruments and robots and, you know, lots of smart people. But explain exactly what it is that you run.
The fields that we access are very broad and you can sort of cluster them a little bit. So we have a lot of work in thinking about kind of the future of some of the hard sciences. So we have a center called the Center for Extreme Bionics, which is really focused on eliminating a lot of what we traditionally call disabilities like amputations or brain disorders through really understanding interfaces, both mechanical, chemical, neurological, and physical interfaces to the brain and the body. So it includes making things like robotic limbs or working on circuits that you can implant in the brain to try to deal with certain types of disorders or even going into sort of genetic and nanotech interventions into the nervous system. And so we're doing a lot that might sound like typical hard sciences. And the reason we do it in a lab like ours is you may need to have somebody who works on designing new types of life, talking to somebody who understands advanced electronics to try to come up with a solution on how you might create an interface for the brain. And typically in traditional disciplines, you know, in neuroscience or in mechanical engineering or electronics, those types of people have a harder time working together. And more importantly, it's harder to get people who understand all of it. So, you know, we often use the word anti-disciplinary instead of interdisciplinary, because interdisciplinary is a chemist talking to a biologist, talking to a physicist. And anti-disciplinary is somebody who doesn't really associate with just one discipline, but is in between in all of them. So one chunk of work that we work on is really sort of understanding a new way of thinking about the hard sciences like biology and neuroscience. There's a lot of work that we do in the future of learning. So our program itself is really a lot about how students and faculty and companies learn through building things and learn through doing things. And we often say learning through construction rather than instruction. But we also think about how that applies to kids. And so we have a group called Lifelong Kindergarten. And the idea is that in kindergarten, kids play, but actually learn a lot through play. And can we sort of extend that to adult? But we have a lot of other initiatives. We do a lot about the future of journalism. We work a lot in the area of the future of media and displays. And I guess the key is we're always trying to do things that other people aren't or wouldn't do. And if everybody else starts doing it, we tend to move on to the next thing.
I'm going to circle back to more of the work that you do at the MIT Media Lab, but I want to find out how you became you. From everything I know, you have been incredibly gifted in the sciences since you were a young child. So what was the first time you remember thinking about science or innovation in a structured way as a child?
So I think the main thing is that I don't think in extremely structured ways, or at least in traditional structured ways. So my father was a chemist, and you know, I grew up in the neighborhood of a lot of academics, and then my father went to work for a company in Michigan called Energy Conversion Devices. And the founder of that company is a genius physicist, but he was a high school dropout. But he had PhDs and Nobel laureates all over the place, and they were designing new types of materials. And in his lab, what was amazing was physics and chemistry and science, everyone talked about it in a very intuitive way. and everyone was building things. And the theory was there, but the theory always came in the context of thinking about things. And I remember as a kid having Stan Ovshinsky, who was the founder, have these pipe cleaners and styrofoam balls, and he'd create these molecules and he'd shake them and he'd talk about, see these dangling bonds, you know, this is probably where we should be putting the germanium. And he'd describe this science in a very artistic way, and he'd have this sort of room full of Nobel laureates scribbling on the board, helping him work out the math. And when I was hanging out with Stan Ovshinsky, I thought that science was about intuition and art, and the way that he described things was very sort of physical and poetic. And when I went to college, I actually dropped out of college 3 times.
That's got to be a record for someone who's successful. Maybe not for someone who's not successful, but well, Bill Gates only dropped out once.
I know. I think my problem is I kept trying. And my thing is, it's not that I don't like academia. I just didn't like, I couldn't find the right interface to it. And so I always tell my students at the Media Lab, if I had been at the Media Lab, I probably would have graduated. It's a very unique approach where it really is about getting kids to be passionate. So Mitch Resnick, who runs the Lifelong Kindergarten Group, often talks about the 4 P's, which are passion, projects, peers, and play. And those are sort of the fundamental things that we believe are important in learning, which I don't think most physics departments have those 4 P's as their primary focus for teaching. So
talk a little bit about play, because when I visited the Media Lab, there is a sense of playfulness, like extreme and passionate playfulness amid very serious work. What does play mean to you?
Play is very important because play is a kind of engagement. It's a different purpose for learning. So it is very related to passion. But I think what's important about play is it's much more creative. So, for instance, there are studies that show that if you give somebody financial reward or put a lot of pressure on somebody, they're much more likely to come up with simple answers very quickly. But they will tend to not provide or have a harder time coming up with creative answers than somebody who is more relaxed or somebody who is playing. And it turns out play is a key component in having people think creatively. And I think in society, you have certain situations where you want people to be not so creative, but reliable and punctual and organized and doing somewhat repetitive tasks. And in those cases, I don't think, you know, play is important. In fact, it could be a distraction. But when you want people to be doing things that are different or thinking creatively, it's important for them to have a sense of play and a sense of passion. And in fact, I would go as far as saying a sense of irreverence, an ability to question authority and think for yourself. And I think as we see computers and robots taking over more and more jobs that involve repetitive physical and mental tasks, we're going to need a workforce that's more and more focused on being creative and being different. And I think that will involve getting even adults to think much more about play in the workplace than we have been so far.
Some of your personal pursuits have included play that also informs your work, DJing, and being part of a World of Warcraft guild, online multiplayer game playing guild. How do things like that influence how you think about what you do?
So DJing was an important point in my career. I was studying physics at University of Chicago at the time in a very organized and, you know, a rigorous class. But at night I was working in a nightclub in downtown on the north side of Chicago, actually. And this was during the 80s. If you remember, that was around the late 80s was when AIDS was a big issue.
Absolutely.
And so what I found was, as a disc jockey, I was in the middle of a community that was struggling. And the city aldermen and the local police and the bouncers at the club and the, you know, goth kids, they were all together trying to help their friends who had AIDS, trying to keep a community together. And the amount of sort of community effort and passion and cohesiveness was extremely educational for me. And as somebody who grew up in a relatively privileged way during parts of my childhood, I'd never really, you know, for lack of a better word, hung out with working class. And to me, what I realized when I was a disc jockey was that this working class environment in the nightclub that I was in was much more socially advanced and compassionate and had a lot more to teach me than sitting in a classroom learning physics. And so I dropped out of college and became a professional disc jockey because I found that the work of the disc jockey also is interesting because at another scale, what a disc jockey does is really trying to read a room, understand the dynamics between the people, and create an environment for the people to have fun and work well together and enjoy themselves, which ultimately becomes my main job in many of the roles that I've had, which is running Creative Commons or running organizations or managing things like the Media Lab. What you're trying to do is it's almost like being a gardener. What you're trying to do is create an environment where people can be what they want to be and where creativity and things flourish. So for me, being a disc jockey was a really, really important point in my learning about society and about communities. The World of Warcraft isn't that different in that it's also interesting because I'm running a guild, and more specifically what we call in these online games raids, which are where you take up to 40 people, you know, and you're talking to each other over headsets, and it's a very complex, coordinated activity. And what's interesting, I mean, doing it myself was interesting, but what was more interesting to me was watching, you know, 8-year-old kids lead 40 adults for 8 hours through this very complicated procedure and maneuver where talking to people and making sure the morale was going was such a important sort of metaphorical learning for that kid about leadership that you wouldn't ever be able to learn as an 8-year-old anywhere else. And so in my World of Warcraft guild as well, there was extreme diversity where we had, you know, soldiers that were deployed in Afghanistan, and we had priests and rabbis and truck drivers and Chinese and Japanese. And what was interesting also, and again, I focus kind of on the kids because I think they were learning the most, was you would see these kids who were in neighborhoods that were completely devoid of diversity for the first time understanding and then appreciating how important diversity was. So there were a lot of things that I saw kids learning in World of Warcraft that I think in a traditional learning environment like a university, we don't have enough of.
You're listening to One with Farai, part of Soundworks from PRI, and I'm speaking with Joy Ito, director of MIT's Media Lab. I want to circle to a couple of things that have come up in previous interviews. It's amazing to me, and one reason that I'm doing this project, I think that we're all interconnected in all sorts of amazing ways, and certain themes have come up again and again. One of them is diversity, which you were just talking about, and I spoke with two Tokyo-based documentarians and curators, David D. Healy and Shizu Yuasa, his wife, about Asia and monoculturalism and multiculturalism and themselves being an intercultural couple who works together. You yourself are what I would consider intercultural, having been raised partly in the U.S., partly in Japan. How do you view your self-identity as part of an increasingly globalized world, but also one where tensions and identities do persist?
It was very difficult as I was growing up trying to figure it out. So I was born in Japan. I moved to the U.S. when I was 2, and then Canada, and then I lived in Detroit. And every vacation, so when we were in the U.S., we would come back to Japan for winter and summer vacation. And when we were in Japan, we'd go to the U.S. for vacation. And so always kind of bouncing back and forth every couple of months, always moving back and forth. So the reason I describe that is that what you end up with is you end up becoming bicultural, which is slightly different than if you move less frequently. When you become bicultural, what's interesting and confusing is that you're always trying to figure out what you are, because you find out that the Japanese think of you as non-Japanese and the Americans think of you as non-American. And then you add to that, when I was growing up in Detroit in the late 70s and then all the way up to the very early 80s, Detroit was going through a transformation where the Japanese auto industry was really putting a lot of the auto workers in Detroit out of work. And so half of the kids in my school were children of unemployed auto workers. So, and I was the only Japanese kid in the school. So obviously I was very unpopular. And it was a struggle because I met a category of racism. And as a kid, you know, when you're going through elementary school and junior high, it's confusing. And then I went to Japan for junior high at an international school. And I went from feeling like the worst category of kid, which is a Japanese kid growing up in Detroit, to Japanese kid who could speak English in an international school, which turns out to be kind of the top of the heap in terms of categories. And I was able to sort of kludge my self-esteem back together. But I think what was important about growing up that way is that you start to first understand the struggles of diversity and trying to build an identity in a multicultural environment. But then later, as I got over the identity part, I started to realize how powerful it was to be able to talk to multiple cultures. And before I came to MIT, I was living in Dubai and I was immersing myself in Arab culture because I really didn't understand Islam or the Arab culture. And obviously I don't have an Arab identity, but understanding that really expanded my ability to think in a different way. And so there's a tremendous amount of power in diversity. There's a tremendous amount of difficulty in getting people to embrace and understand diversity and create an identity within that. But I think it's tremendously important in today's world, both in the context of a university administrator as well as thinking about sort of world peace and international relations.
And we also spoke with Alec Ross, formerly of the State Department, who's finishing a book on globalization. And, you know, we spoke with him quite a bit about identity and economics and jobs and all of the different ways that globalization intersects with our lives. But one fascinating side conversation we had was about genomics and whether or not the developments currently going on in genomics would be beneficial to everyone in the short run, perhaps in the long run. But what we discussed and what he made a good case for was that scientific innovation would increase inequality, in this case, health inequality. And because health is part of what the MIT Media Lab addresses, I was just curious if you had any thoughts on that.
We do a lot of work in genomics, and today we have the technology now to go in and edit genes in our kids. And we know enough about genes to start taking certain types of disabilities or certain types of diseases and eliminating them through modifying genes. And that understanding of how to modify our genes will continue to advance and continue to get cheaper. And I think, you know, we have an incredible spectrum of possible things that could happen. You know, everything from figuring out something close to immortality and kids hacking viruses in their garage, causing a human extinction event, you know, and everything in between. And I think that the income disparity, access to medical and genetic technology is one very important thing that you and Alec probably talked about. I do think it's getting cheaper. Obviously, the rich people are going to get it first. I think what's important is to start having this conversation in the public sphere. I think that sort of bioethics is difficult to talk about because it has, you know, a lot of philosophical and moral implications. But I think one key thing is that it's moving very, very fast. So, you know, there are certain elements of synthetic biology that are moving even faster than Moore's law, which is the law that computers, you know, double in speed every 18 months. So I often use the metaphor, you remember 20 years ago when everyone thought only the nerds had to know anything about the internet, but now everybody uses it. I think similarly within our lifetimes, where you and I are going to be fairly literate about synthetic biology, and it's never too early to start really thinking about it because, like this podcast, I think we need to be talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think about the impact of genomics and other healthcare interventions in a world where, you know, not everything is apportioned equally and fairly. Those are two different things. But it strikes me that when we talk about things like innovation, there's regulatory structures and then there's what people kind of do when they're off-roading. Do you have any concerns that some of the innovation that's going to take place will essentially be what I call off-roading, meaning not even dealing with regulatory questions, just forging ahead and later letting the chips fall where they may?
Yeah, so I think there are some really good things that will happen from, I often call it street bio or DIY bio, because the cost is going down. I'm actually, after this interview, going to be finishing up my safety training. So I'll be working in a wet lab hacking genomics myself because wow. I want to understand how hard or easy it is. I just got back from Kenya, and one of the things that I definitely want to do is I want to take some of this DIY bio to Kenya and work with the kids that I met there who are super smart, who could figure this out very easily. If I can figure it out, they can figure it out. And I want them to start thinking about how can we cure malaria? How can we create new seeds that allow farmers to modify their crops, but in a way that's sustainable. Instead of trying to figure out how we can, you know, design genetic solutions here in America that then we ship off to Africa, you know, the University of Nairobi and the kids on the street and that I was meeting there, they can probably really start working on this stuff themselves. So what's exciting to me, and again, there's obviously the dark side, which is, you know, you can make mistakes. So we need to figure out how to deal with those things. But the upside is that the cost of innovation for this stuff has gone down. And so if you're not tinkering with human genomics, which requires a much more testing, but if you're working on things, and you can still mess up with agriculture. So I'm not saying it's simple or easy and we have to put a lot of safety things in place. But if you teach all of that, I think it's much more likely that the people who are living in the environment where the intervention needs to happen, they have much more incentive, they have much more local know-how. And that to me is exciting. And so I think that rather than thinking about synthetic biology happening in these ivory towers and do the, you know, the poor people get access to the to those inventions, I think giving everyone access to the technology itself is one of the things that we can use to equalize.
Tell me a little bit more about Kenya. Is this a partner site that you have, or you're just working with kids on your own?
So we have a program called the Director's Fellows, which are people that I choose to invite to the Media Lab and then to represent us in their regions, because I'm trying to increase the diversity of the type of people that we interact with, people who we wouldn't normally run into through the course of looking for students or looking for faculty. And in Kenya, we have two great fellows, Juliana Rodage and David Kobia, who started this nonprofit called Ushahidi that did the crisis mapping in Haiti and things like that. But they've
Absolutely.
Got a wonderful place in Kenya, in Nairobi, called iHub, which is a kind of a hackerspace. And it's just amazing. I brought a dozen students and two faculty with me. And what they worked on was, you know, they worked on anti-poaching. They worked on some of the air quality monitoring issues. They worked with a local prostheticist on thinking about how to improve prostheses work in the region. And they worked on things like traffic issues. But what was amazing was working with the local innovators and the local kids. And to me, what was really surprising is there's a program there called Akira Chicks. And it was a couple of young women who realized that there weren't as many women hanging out in this tech spaces. So they started going to these high schools and evangelizing the idea of girls becoming geeks. And this is, I think, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And now they're super successful. And half the kids that were in this space were women. And they had succeeded in hugely impacting gender diversity in this relatively substantial tech community in Nairobi. So to me, what was really great about this is our kids came away having learned so much. The way that the people in Kenya think about their animals and the pride that they have, the way they think about wasting resources, it was just so much energy, so vibrant, and not the kind of Africa that any of these kids had imagined before they went there. This is an Africa that were truly innovating and truly in charge of their futures.
Yeah, when you're talking about the resource issue, I also recently did some media training for young global social entrepreneurs, and one of them was working with EcoBricks, which are basically plastic containers filled with plastic waste and used as construction material. So it's a way to stop landfill. And there's a project in South Africa using these EcoBricks, which then can be covered in clay and made to look attractive. So how do we cross-pollinate some of these positives of lean countries back into our more resource-rich world?
I think the key is humility and sort of leaving your sort of high horse sort of thing at the door. Because I think we grow up in America with this idea, how can he be smart if he isn't rich? Kind of this association that smart people are rich and rich people are smart. That's kind of one thing. The other thing, the idea that high tech is more sophisticated than low tech. Well, in fact, like your bricks, a lot of low-tech things, cheaper things, are much more sophisticated, much more successful than a lot of technology. And I think, you know, whether it's the motion picture industry or just the sort of American dream, we have this ethos in America that more expensive, higher tech, fancy things are better. And this, you know, less is more frugality is a kind of aesthetic that I think you need to learn. But you learn by going to a place where it's being done very successfully. And even in places like Detroit, where it's in the United States, it may not seem like the obvious place. When we go with our students and work with the urban farmers and we bring in things like sensors and all this technology, and the urban farmers say, well, I don't need your sensors. I got the best sensors in the world right here. And they point at their eyes and they say, you know, I'm interested in composting and things that we can use. And by the end of the interaction that we had in Detroit, our kids had been working and started working on, you know, developing helpful ways to do compost. So, and then the kids in Detroit said, I was sitting next to an MIT kid and my idea won. And then the MIT kid said, you know, I could never have designed this thing sitting in Cambridge where we have all these tools. It was harder, more challenging, much more rewarding to work with the kids that we were working with in Detroit to create a solution using things that you could buy within walking distance, building it with the people in Detroit, and then having the people in Detroit embrace these things because they're from the community. And what's great about this for me is it's a two-way thing because our kids at MIT are smart. And they go in and they have an interesting perspective and they're irreverent. So they'll, you know, for instance, they'll rip apart a flashlight and teach the kids in Detroit that, well, actually the electronics aren't that hard and you can do this and create a little wearable thing so that you don't have to rely on streetlights, for instance. And the kids in Detroit will say, oh, wow, I didn't realize you could just rip open a flashlight. But by the way, this is how we would design and this is how we would do it. And that interaction is really wonderful. And I think that anybody can contribute to this. I'm going to pivot a little bit your question because I think in Kenya and a lot of those places, they already understand this idea that everything is hackable, everything can be repaired. I think one of the problems about some of the more frugal environments in America is that we have such a consumer society that people don't think to repair and people don't think that anything that you find is something that you can strip down for parts and rebuild into something else. And that's actually an ethos that you get in a place like MIT. And so by transferring, we call it the hacker mentality, into an environment where you have smart kids, it's also kind of infectious. And I think that ties to this idea of, you know, somebody coming up with this idea for these bricks, because it's likely that the person who invented that was only able to invent that because they were immersed in the environment that it would be used.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, before we get ready to wrap this up, I wanted to ask you about the E14 fund that you have to allow students to extend their entrepreneurial dreams. I mean, this is something that some schools are experimenting with, but there's also been this movement to tell smart, especially technology-oriented kids to drop out of school. So what's this project and how does it work?
So the E14 Fund is just one project in the beginning of a longer array of things that we want to do to encourage entrepreneurship. And I think the key for me is that as the cost of, you know, building things and distributing things went down around the internet, what you saw was that innovation moved from large institutions with lots of money to dorm rooms and startups because you didn't need tons of money to create a Facebook or a Yahoo or a Google at the beginning. You didn't even need permission, you just did it. And in the old days, when you needed $100 million to create an internet site or actually an online site, or you needed millions of dollars to do anything interesting, typically what universities would do is they would create ideas, or even the Media Lab, we would create a demo that a large company would then turn into a thing. So at the Media Lab, it's things like the e-ink for the Kindle or the Lego Mindstorms or Guitar Hero. They were all commercialized by large companies, and we still do that. But as the cost of building hardware and even things like bioengineering go down, the ability for a student to spin out and create a company, for instance, is becoming easier. And I think universities were traditionally designed to educate and create workers for large research institutions and companies. So you either became an academic or you joined a big company. And the path to entrepreneurship, even though people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs have done it in the past, it was a hard thing to do. You sort of did it despite the system. And I think that the E14 Fund, which is a fund that invests in and supports graduates of the Media Lab, is the first step. But I think the longer term goal is to try to make entrepreneurship more of an official thing, even while you're a student.
And before I let you go, I'd like you to play a little game that we're calling Exquisite. And it's where a previous guest on One with Farai asks a question of the current guest. So take a listen.
The thing that at the moment that is crowding almost all other concerns out is my concern for climate change and rising sea levels. And I'm wanting to know if it's true for others.
So what do you say, Joy?
So climate change is one of, if not the most important issue on my mind. As a board member of the MacArthur Foundation, one of the things we think a lot about is how we impact climate change. And I think that's also with my position at MIT, is it important to get people to understand and believe the science and for us to win the argument about climate change? Or is it important to focus singularly on trying to figure out ways to mitigate and to recover from and deal with the impacts of climate change? And so the theory of change around climate change is actually quite complicated and something that all of us don't have a consensus around. It's also a broader issue on the role of science in society and the ability for science to influence things like policy. There's so many things that are obvious academically. Climate change is probably the biggest one of them, but even things like mass incarceration, we know that mass incarceration, putting people in jail, doesn't help. But we can't seem to get rid of the system that's destroying our youth in many cities. And so it's a key issue in terms of the future of humanity, but also there's a lot of meta questions to me around the role of science and the role of policy. So I completely concur with the previous guest.
And that guest was Betty Reed Soskin. She's a 92-year-old, full-time employed national park ranger. So she has seen a lot of changes in this country and in this world. Now it's your turn. You get to ask a question of our next guest. And not only is it our next guest, it's our next season, which starts in the fall. So it can be on any topic that you choose. And what would you like to ask of someone who you don't know, haven't met?
So if you look at the current advances in medicine and bioengineering, there's a fairly high likelihood that either we will have the ability to be immortal, or at least we will see how it might happen, and our children or grandchildren will have a potential ability to become immortal. First of all, is immortality a good thing or a bad thing? And how should we as human beings think about immortality? Because I don't think it's an option anymore to not invent it. It's going to happen.
Wow. I have much less scientific knowledge than you. I personally would be horrified at the idea of immortality.
Me too. And it's one I struggle with because the more I study, the more I am convinced that we will see immortality and it will be an ethical discussion that we're going to have in our lifetime.
Wow. I definitely think we're going to have massive life extension.
Yeah.
Immortality, however, it's a whole other William Gibson-esque thing, but absolutely fascinating. I can't wait to hear who we get to answer that. Joy Ito, thank you so much for joining us on One with Farai.
Thank you.
Joy Ito is director of MIT's Media Lab. You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. Visit soundworks.org to find other podcasts as well as past episodes of One with Farai. We'll see you in the fall with our second season.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.